going to read the scriptures and go straight into the lecture. We're going to read the scriptures. You turn to John chapter 14. And as you're turning, if you are, just to say, we sung a hymn about union with Christ. We're having a reading about union with Christ. You may wonder what that's got to do with the situation under Elizabeth I, but I hope it will become rapidly clear. John 14 from verse 15 to verse 24, a passage which certainly fits what we've just sung, because that great truth of union with Christ is based on this teaching. John 14 verse 15, Jesus says, "If you love me, keep my commandments, and I will pray the Father, and he will give you another helper, that he may abide with you forever, the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it neither sees him nor knows him. But you know him, for he dwells with you and will be in you. I will not leave you orphans, I will come to you. A little while longer and the world will see me no more, but you will see me. Because I live, you will live also. At that day you will know that I am in my Father, and you in me, and I in you. He who has my commandments and keeps them, it is he who loves me, and he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him." Judas, not Iscariot, said to him, "Lord, how is it that you will manifest yourself to us and not to the world?" Jesus answered and said to him, "If anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him. He who does not love me does not keep my words, and the word which you hear is not mine, but the Father's who sent me." It was a very valid question of Judas about Christ manifesting himself to us, the disciples, and not to the world. That distinction, of course, runs through everything, and it runs through our lecture tonight. Brief introduction to where we're at. We looked at 2 weeks at talks at the battle for the gospel, and saw how it was from the time of Henry VIII until the settlement that Elizabeth brought in, that it brought in freedom for the gospel, which has never been rescinded since then. So that is a major advance. But in the next four, including this talk, I want to head them each together, the struggle for pure churches. We're looking tonight at the reign of Elizabeth I from 1558 to 1603, but this struggle continued right up until 1715. Let me explain the difference. Many Christians had flooded back into the country after Mary Tudor. Others raised their heads for Reformation once more. But the situation was that Elizabeth passed in 1562 the Act of Uniformity, which, this is where we finished last time, which said that everybody had to be in the Church of England, and the Church of England worship had to be carried out exactly the same in every place. You had bishops appointed by the crown. They would appoint the vicars, and everybody had to wear the right clothes and use the prayer book. And if you went into any Anglican church, it should be exactly the same, except it was a different chap at the front. That was the picture. And the Act of Supremacy also, which meant that she was supreme governor of the Church of England. So there was freedom for the gospel, but only if you were an ordained man within the Church of England, and only you would keep that freedom if you conform to the rules about reading the prayer book or wearing the right clerical vestments. It's amazing how important that became as an issue. Otherwise, you were persecuted. In other words, the idea of a church was that it's inclusive of everybody in the country, an inclusive institution based on creedal belief. You are supposed to believe the 39 Articles. But it also is meant to include everyone in the country, which of course brings an irresolvable tension. You cannot have any institution which says everyone in the country is in it, but you've also got to believe certain things to be in it, because what if you don't? But there were increasingly people, right from the beginning of Elizabeth's reign, who were not seeing the church like that, who were beginning to see, and their clarity grew during this period and after it, that the church is not an inclusivist institution. It is the gathered people of those who are in Christ, which is what we've been singing and reading of. And that perception, as I say, grew during this period. And therefore you had the tension between two views of what the church is. And Elizabeth was very much on the former side, the side of the institution, the side of the rules laid down by her and people under her. And the people who were increasingly saying that is not the biblical picture of how the church should be were those who were more and more becoming persecuted because of that. And I want to start with Scotland, because the history lecture is on England only, but we need to bring in Scotland at this point, because the example of Scotland was in many minds, not least Elizabeth's. There'd been freedom to read the Bible in 1543 in Scotland, and don't want to go into all the ins and outs, but you got this man in the end, John Knox, who'd been a preacher, who'd been captured by the French, exiled, was pastor of the English church in Frankfurt under the previous reign, Mary Tudor's, and there was this division there between those like him who didn't and other men who did want the church there to be conforming to the prayer book, just like as if it was actually in England. And he lost that battle. And he returned in the end to Scotland in 1559 and brought about, under God, a reformation by his preaching. He was opposed by Mary of Guise, who was the Queen Regent, the mother of the infant Mary, Queen of Scots. But she died in June 1559, and the Reformation flourished and was established the next year with a Presbyterian system of church government. Now, I'm not a Presbyterian, but I suppose I'm more a Presbyterian than an Anglican, in the sense that the whole idea of Presbyterianism, at least, is that what is the church? Well, it's the people, and they choose their own leaders. They choose their own preachers. And then you have a hierarchical system, and that's not, I believe, in the scripture. But at least the bottom line is meant to be that it's something that's free from state control. They believed in an established Presbyterian church, but one which the government would support and help, but had freedom within it to run its own affairs and elect its own leaders. And that was a step forward. And that came in Scotland. Mary, Queen of Scots, of course, fled to England in the end. And the Reformation succeeded in Scotland for two reasons, humanly speaking. The people wanted it because they'd been reading their Bibles. They wanted Protestantism. And there was a weak crown, which meant that the system of church government could be instituted by Knox, who'd been influenced by what he'd seen in Geneva and Strasbourg on the continent. And Elizabeth learnt that lesson. And she was happy enough with people wanting Reformation in England and wanting the gospel and not wanting to be Roman Catholic, certainly. But she also learnt the lesson that, well, I'm the Queen and I must not let go on power. She just wanted to get her own way. I've got my view of the church and I'm going to make sure that prevails. And that is really the background to all this battle. I want to divide what I'm saying onwards now into four sections, not of equal length. And the first is to deal with Elizabeth and the Puritans. Now, you can use the word Puritan, I think I said this last time, in much wider ways or narrower ways. I'm using it in its really narrow sense. Those who were within the Church of England from 1562 to 1662, when they got kicked out, who wanted to purify the Church of England. Some wanted to go further than others, but that is where the word Puritan comes from. Men who were Calvinistic in doctrine, who were Presbyterian in government, who saw the Church of England as part of a wider European reform movement, and they looked to Geneva, and they looked to Holland, and they looked to Scotland, and they said, we want that here. And they said, look, we were getting somewhere under Edward VI, and it was interrupted rudely by Mary Tudor, violently. But now we have a Protestant queen, let us complete the work of Reformation. And their completion was, as we've spoken of, that's what they thought would be complete in terms of church government. There was a very large Puritan section, probably a majority in the clergy, for these reasons. First, because many of these leaders had been exposed to Presbyterianism on the continent in Geneva and Strasbourg and Zurich, where they'd fled from Mary. So they saw state-appointed bishops as wrong. And some of these men became bishops because Elizabeth didn't have anyone better to put in their place. Well, they were probably fine men, but she didn't have anyone better from her point of view. So, for example, Edmund Grindal, Bishop of London, was certainly someone who stood for this Presbyterian system. And these men had been were continually being influenced also by Calvin's institutes. This became the accepted theological textbook at the universities of Oxford and Cambridge. After that, Bullinger's Decades, again, which developed covenant theology. Peter Martyr, who'd been at Oxford, wrote a very influential commentary on Romans in 1558 and other books, including on union with Christ and on the Lord's Supper. And these books were what people were reading. This was moulding the thought of these leaders, these men who were wanting to purify the Church of England. Calvin's expositions, Calvin's commentaries were enormously influential. And of course, these men were coming against the background of the justified wariness of the papacy. They'd just seen what Mary Tudor had been doing. And it led to a wariness of anything in doctrine or practice which seemed to be Romish or would tend to lead back to Rome. So yes, of course, they were going to oppose the Mass and false doctrines, but they said, well, look, this is just Catholicism here we've got, really. We've got the gospel, but we've got these bishops. That's a Catholic idea. They're wearing special clothes. That's a Catholic idea. They're reading from a prayer book. Well, the Mass book was a Catholic idea. These things, this is only a partway reformation. We have got to complete the work and get back to the scriptures. And I think also we can say that they saw that the new wine of the gospel which they were preaching couldn't be kept within these old wineskins of the Catholic structures, state-appointed territorial bishops, enforced rules on prayers and clothes. They had renewed minds. They were saying, well, why should we try and confine church life in this way? They were beginning to come to the point, of course, which we think is so obvious, but it wasn't obvious to them, that the church is more than just what's done on Sundays by a man at the front. They were beginning to think of the church as the gathered company of believers. They hadn't fully seen the implications of that yet. They hadn't seen it for church membership. They hadn't seen it for baptism. But they weren't thinking of the church now just as the church is the hierarchy who does what they're told and everybody else just comes and listens. The idea that, which would have been Elizabeth's idea, what was a good Christian for Elizabeth? Someone who turned up in church, because you got fined if you didn't, and you went through those rituals, and you listened to the preaching, gospel preaching, biblical preaching, and you went away and you certainly didn't form any other little groups for worship, and then you went away and you just lived the rest of your life and you kept the Ten Commandments or whatever, and that was a good Christian. It's outward, it's formal. And these men were seeing that this was not enough. And so they tried to change things. They didn't lose any time. The year after the Acts of Uniformity and Supremacy, there was a petition in the Convocation of the Church of England, it's the equivalent of now of the Synod, to abolish the practices disliked by the Puritans. We're used to, at the moment, aren't we, to tight votes in Parliament. This petition was lost by one vote. We don't know what Elizabeth would have done had it been passed. But people thought that well, we're on a roll, but the roll has been stopped a little bit, but we're still on the roll. It'll prevail one day. And a few years later, they brought forward proposals in the Commons, 1571 to 72, to alter the prayer book to satisfy the Puritan demands. And these seemed to be going through, and they were stopped, the proceedings, by the direct command of Elizabeth. And that led to the first and second admonitions to Parliament, the first by two men called John Field and Thomas Wilcox, the second by a man called Thomas Cartwright, of whom we'll have to say more, admonitions to Parliament to set up Presbyterianism. Now, who was Cartwright? Well, he certainly wasn't some firebrand from the backwoods. He was Cambridge educated. He was appointed as Lady Margaret Professor of Divinity at Cambridge in 1569. So that's who he was at this time. He was a brilliant scholar. Theodore Beza, the post-Calvin leader of Geneva, spoke of Cartwright as the most learned man he knew. He was also a celebrated university preacher, and his sermons drew huge crowds. He was a theologian, he was a preacher, he was a man who was, you know, one of the leading lights in the Church of England. And he's saying, no, we should have a system, a Presbyterian system, a system where rule comes up from below and we not have our leaders appointed from above. Edmund Grindal became Archbishop of Canterbury from London in 1575, and he quickly got into hot water. At that time, they used to have these meetings which they would call prophesyings, which really, the title misleads us in our day. It was meetings, I suppose you call them ministers' fraternals, where they would meet together and they would, by agreement, each have prepared a sermon on the same passage of Scripture, and they would preach it to each other, and then they would helpfully criticise each other's preaching. It was meant to aid them in their preaching, their understanding. How do we put the word across? This was of benefit. These men wanted to preach the Bible better. And Elizabeth said to Grindal, you've got to stop these. She was no fan of the people preaching, really, at all. And Grindal refused and was forced to retire. And so in 1580, Thomas Cartwright and a man called Walter Travers brought forward a book of discipline. And they said, well, look, we're going to set up a Presbyterian system anyway. We're going to keep it within the Church of England. We're going to set up groups of ministers in different places, and they will meet together as a presbytery, and the ministers will obey the presbytery, not the bishop. But they'll be ordained by the bishop to satisfy the law, but they will actually operate as a sort of church within a church. And the first such was set up at Cookfield in Sussex in 1582. And the ministers there hired others to come in and read the prayers from the prayer book. And after those prayers had been read on the Sunday to satisfy the law, they would then enter the building and preach the word. These men, I think, had a varying commitment by now to the establishment principle. Some still saw the idea of an established church. Others were beginning to say the church shouldn't really be controlled by the state at all. But they varied on that. Well, Elizabeth wanted something done about this. In 1583, John Whitgift became Archbishop of Canterbury. He, and he was not alone in this, was a man who was both strongly anti-Puritan. We would call him, in our terms, an Anglican. He was in favour of the Church of England as a church which incorporated everybody, and everybody did the same thing. But he was also strongly a Calvinist. We must not think that all the people who opposed Puritanism were anti-gospel in some way. They weren't. They were people who didn't see the need to change the structures of the church. And you might say, well, that's a sort of secondary issue, isn't it? Well, it is, except that it wasn't a secondary issue for these people because of what happened to them. He began to use the law against Puritans. Many preachers were suspended for Presbyterianism. In 1588, some tracts were put forth, the Mar Prelate tracts, against episcopacy, and the authors were put to death. In the persecution which followed, Cartwright was imprisoned. In 1593, the Conventicle Act was passed, which basically said it's illegal to have meetings for Christians outside of the church buildings and the church services. And all who wouldn't conform were to be banished. Some conformed, others became separatists. We'll get to them in a minute. Some left for Holland. We need to understand, if you haven't by now, that if you had a view, because you've been taught this, that somehow Elizabeth I was one of the good guys, although she's a woman, all right, this isn't true. She was for the gospel. She was absolutely against churches like us. If we were in Elizabeth's time, someone came in through the door, law officer, we'd all be in prison. Because we're not worshipping just in the Church of England, according to the prayer book on Sundays. And of course, some went further than Puritanism. So we have to look at Elizabeth and the separatists. Now, this varied in different parts of the country. If you go back two centuries before this, you've got John Wycliffe, and he's preaching and he's sending people out two by two, and they're preaching the gospel, these people called Lollards. And they had had most influence in what we might call the southeastern half of England. You draw a line from somewhere like Devon or Bristol up to Lincolnshire, they had much more influence south and east of that than north and west. And that division still continued. You could argue, even perhaps today, that there is more influence for the gospel in that part southeast than in the northwest. I don't know if you would argue that, but we can talk about that. But the point is, their descendants couldn't agree with the Church of England, and they had remained separate, at least in heart, all the way through under Roman Catholicism. And now you've got the Church of England, and they say, oh, well, the Reformation isn't being completed in the Church of England. No, we're not going to be part of it. We're going to be separate as much as we can be. At the beginning of the reign, Archbishop Parker said, the realm is overrun with Anabaptists. John Jewell mentioned him later. We found a large crop of Anabaptists springing up overnight like mushrooms. Now, this was unfair on many. Doubtless they found Anabaptists. Anabaptists, the people who were baptized again, people who believed in believers' baptism, in London mostly, refugees from the continent. And these people are not our spiritual forebears as Reformed Baptists. There's no direct line between them and us. We didn't spring from them. Indeed, these people, almost to a man, rejected the doctrines of grace. Often these groups rejected the Trinity. Some of them rejected the deity of Christ. They were sects. One of the people who would be the best among them, a leader, for example, in Holland, and some of them were his followers, was a man called Menno Simons, from whom we get the Mennonites. He was Trinitarian, but he condemned Zwingli's doctrine of predestination as an abomination of abominations. He rejected justification by faith. He was docetic in his view of Christ. He believed Christ just appeared to be a man. These were not people who would be part of our church. They practiced believers' baptism, but they were not our forebears. If you want to get, and we are anticipating, but if you want to look at how you got churches like ours to begin in this country, well, here the separatists, who were not these Anabaptists, we're going to see, who were basically congregational in church government, and it was out of them in the next century that we've got the Reformed Baptist beginnings. Because these people you see who Jewell and Parker were speaking about, well, they were Anabaptists, but there weren't really many people who we would regard even in any way as our forebears. But during the reign, many separatists grew up. Some were refugees from continental persecutions where they'd seen there was a better way than a state church. Others left the Church of England and went further. You know, they weren't just within to try and make it Presbyterian. They said, we've got to leave it. Some left when clerical vestments were enforced in 1565. So that's 3 years after the prayer book's been brought in, and they start to enforce this. It was enforced first in London, not the London that we know in the sense of size. This was the city of London, the square mile. And there were many churches in it, but 37 people, vicars, in the church is in London alone refused to wear the clerical vestments. They said they're popish. And they were disciplined in various ways. Many of them had their licenses taken away to preach. A man called Robert Fitz, set up what he called the Privy Church of London, private church, a gathered church. This is perhaps the first, we don't know. It had 15 members in 1567. It had 56 in 1592, but it was an underground church. And when people got caught, they got imprisoned, and many died in prison. We think the prison conditions today are bad, but not like they were then. 24 of his members died in 1 year in prison. So if you add up all the people who died, this church was growing. In 1571 in Norwich, 2,925 separatists, they reckoned. By 1587, it was the majority of the citizens and of the council of the city. Many were arrested. Another man who was a separatist leader was a man called Robert Brown. He was influenced by Cartwright, but he went further. He founded a congregational church in Norwich in 1572. At the age of 22, he wrote a book which became very influential, A Treatise of Reformation Without Tarrying for Any. Tells you what it means, doesn't it? In other words, we are going to look at the scriptures and we're going to see what the church should be like and we're going to build it on the scriptures. And if there are other people who are saying, well, maybe we'll get a bit of change, go down. He's saying, no, we've got to do it. We've just got to obey God. Wasn't it interesting in the reading that Jesus kept saying, it's those who love me will obey my commandments. They're the ones I will dwell within. In 1582, his church had to flee to Holland. Brown, in fact, rejoined the Church of England. But churches like his began to grow. In 1593, you had the executions, infamously, of three Cambridge graduates, Congregationalists. One was a man called John Greenwood. He was the foremost separatist leader in London, originally a follower of Cartwright. Another was a man called Henry Barrow, who again wrote a very influential book called A True Description of the Visible Congregation of the Saints. Again, you see, that's exactly what it spoke about. What is a true church? And the third man was John Penry, who was probably the main author of the Mar Prelate Tracts. And these people were burnt as heretics by Elizabeth. Now we have to understand what is going on here and why. This brings us to our fourth point. The first was the brief bit about Scotland, then we looked at Elizabeth and the Puritans, Elizabeth and the Separatists. Because all of this is going on against the background of the Counter-Reformation, of the attempts by Rome to bring England back into the Catholic fold. Philip II, who'd married Mary Tudor, when he came over here, said, I am going to a crusade, not a marriage feast. His aim was to make England Roman Catholic again. He was a fanatic. Mary died, and he wanted to marry Elizabeth. Elizabeth famously said to him, as a reply to his marriage proposal passed on to her, she says she cannot marry your majesty because she is a heretic. So you see, I mean, Elizabeth was standing for the gospel, and that way it's just that she, the doctrine of the church, she would oppress people who didn't agree with her view of the church. You can see where the pressure's coming from. She believes, and many believed with her, that the threat is Rome and we've all got to stand together. And there's no room for Protestants to divide, and therefore you just do things her way for the sake of strength and stability. She was wrong in that, but that was where she's coming from. In 1569, there was a major Roman Catholic revolt in the north of England. That's 7 years, remember, after Elizabeth came to the throne. A revolt aimed at putting Mary, Queen of Scots, on the throne. Mary, as a young lady now, well, a child still really, was the heiress of England. She was the legitimate next heir after Elizabeth, because she was the granddaughter of Henry VIII's sister Margaret. Of course, her son, in the end, did become King of England, as well as Scotland, James VI and I. But this revolt was led by the Earls of Northumberland and Westmoreland. You see, this isn't a peasants' revolt. These are the major landowners, the major lords of the north, who'd always known a fair amount of freedom from London. It's a long way from London, and you know, you more could get on with things the way you wanted. And they raised this revolt. They were not alone in this. They had a payment of 12,000 crowns from the Pope, however much that is, but it was a lot of money. They took over Durham Cathedral. They tore the Bible into pieces, and they set up the Mass. This was an attempt to restore Rome. They were violently put down, and many were executed. As a result of that, and all these things that I'm talking about here actually follow one from the other from that. It's quite strange. You see this. There's a connection. Because of that revolt being put down, the Pope issued a bull excommunicating and deposing Elizabeth and releasing her subjects from her allegiance. Well, many Roman Catholics, of course, well, they were all in a cleft stick. If they obeyed the Pope, they had to disobey Elizabeth. If they disobeyed Elizabeth, they were in trouble. Many believed they should obey this, and many didn't believe they should obey it. But those who believed they should obey it were now regarded, I think rightly, as traitors, because they were saying we will obey the Pope rather than our Queen. But many left the Roman Catholics, probably only about 100,000 left, mainly in the north of England. Lancashire was a hotbed of it. And these people were called recusants, those who had recused from the Church of England. Now, I said all these things are connected. In 1571, as a result of that, it was declared treason to reconcile anyone to Rome or to be reconciled to Rome. And if you were caught, you were put to death by hanging, drawing, and quartering. In 1574, the priests began to arrive, following the Pope's bull, secretly from the English college where they'd been trained up at Douai in France. And these are the people who, you know about the all these houses with priest holes and secret stairs and whatever, it's from this time on. These were people who were going round to the Catholics in the country to say Mass for them and to do this in secret. Because if they got caught, they were killed. But in 1581, it was stepped up. The Jesuit mission arrived in England. They were not so much worried about going around giving Mass to hidden Catholics. Their idea was to assassinate Elizabeth. And they had many plots to do this. And in 1585, therefore, it was declared treason for any priest to remain in England. You see, it's all a ratcheting up, isn't it? In 1586, Mary, Queen of Scots, was fully implicated in one of these plots, the Babington plot, and executed the next year. And as a result of that, the next year, 1588, Philip organised the Spanish Armada. The Pope, if it succeeded, was going to pay them 1,000,000 ducats. He learned his lesson. You don't pay the money in advance to rebels. The ships were to sail from France to the Spanish Netherlands to take the army on board to conquer England and to put Philip's daughter Isabella on the throne. Just want to quote a little bit about the Armada to say that, this is Owen Chadwick, 180 monks and friars sailed with the Spanish Armada. Philip II and the Pope agreed to elevate the exiled Cardinal Allen into the offices of Lord Chancellor and Archbishop of Canterbury if the invasion should succeed. At the time of the Armada, Allen printed a tirade denouncing the Queen as a bastard, a usurper and a heretic, and a band of 700 English exiles marched with the Spanish army of the Netherlands to prepare the invasion. We know, I'm sure, roughly what happened. As the Armada was there to pick up the army, which wasn't ready, off the coast of Belgium, the English sent fireships, Drake sent fireships in amongst them, and many were destroyed. The rest fled. They fled northwards. They were destroyed by storms. Many didn't get back to Spain. Some did. A medal was struck by Elizabeth. God blew with his winds, and they were scattered. It was a great deliverance by God for the sake of the gospel going on. Now, I wanted to say all that because you might say, well, that's not really church history. Well, it is, in the sense that we have to remember that after Elizabeth got to the throne, the Roman Catholics didn't just sit there and say, oh, what a shame, England has become Protestant. They were really trying to bring it back. And this is the whole background against which all that we've been looking at up to now was taking place. These battles to get pure gospel churches, some people seeing it better than others, how far they should go. Others saying, no, we've got to stay with the Anglican establishment and obey the Queen. And it's all against this background. That's why we're calling it part one of the struggle for pure churches. And the fifth point, I just want to talk about some people. Because if I've been talking about the Puritans, I'm sure there are some of you at least who've been saying, oh, well, tell us about some of the Puritans then. Tell us about some of these famous Puritan preachers, Richard Sibbes, Thomas Brooks, John Flavel, John Owen. But I'm not going to, simply because they weren't alive yet. The Puritan flowering of preachers happened in the next century. When we get there, God willing, we will talk about these men. Briefly to consider them and their essence of Puritanism in preaching and life, but we haven't got to them yet. But I want to talk very briefly about two examples of early Puritans. One is a man who really, without him, under God, there wouldn't have been any of them. This is William Perkins. He was born in 1558, and he died, which is the year Elizabeth came to the throne, and he died in 1602, which is the year before she died. I'll quote from Peter Lewis, I think, actually. And he says, Perkins was a patriarchal figure in English Puritanism, and his preaching in Cambridge proved to be a formative influence upon the preaching movement in its 17th century development. An accomplished theologian, he was a fellow of Christ College and a lecturer at St. Andrews. His preaching remained clear, practical, and very powerful. And he began to preach. He preached expositorily, which was something that Calvin had done, but he was bringing this back in, and he would preach to the people. He preached from the pulpit, but he would preach to the people in front of him. He would preach in a way which was experimental, which dealt with the soul, with its hopes and its fears and its temptations. He wasn't just giving learned theological discourse. It was almost a new style of preaching. And he influenced many, many students at Cambridge, and the whole flowering of the Puritan preaching movement comes really from that one man. And also, to an extent, in a very different way, from Henry Smith. Henry Smith, born in 1560, died in 1591 at the age of 31. This is Peter Lewis again. Henry Smith was, in his brief day, the orator par excellence of the movement. Less developed than later Puritan sermons, Smith's had the root of the matter in them and were clothed in a rich, native style of eloquence. Crowds flocked to hear the silver-tongued Smith, as he was called, in St. Clement Danes, London, where he was lecturer, and loved to sit utterly under his spell. Thomas Fuller, the historian, his church was so crowded with auditors that persons of good quality brought their own pews with them, I mean their legs, to stand upon in the aisles. Their ears did so attend to his lips, their hearts to their ears, that he held the rudder of their affections in his hands, so that he could steer them whither he was pleased. And he was pleased to steer them only to God's glory and their own good. Dying at 31, we may well say he lived long in a little time. It seems incredible that Henry Smith's London ministry lasted only 3 years, but during this period he took the city by storm, was suspended for his Puritanism, and was so popular that printers' men took down his sermons as he preached and rushed them immediately into print willy-nilly. His printed sermons continued to be for generations a household book and passed through a very large number of editions. You had people who would have the Bible, wouldn't have many books. In the next century, they might have Pilgrim's Progress, but they would have Henry Smith's sermons. And then later on, they might have one or two other books as well. But he had an immense influence in his printed sermons. Think of Spurgeon later on, that kind of influence, all over the country. And then I want to speak about one more man as we come to a close. I want to speak of a very different man, John Jewell. We've mentioned him already. An example of the better sort of Anglican, because I don't want to give a false impression here. Here was a man who was clearly Protestant and vehemently Protestant, but happy with the Elizabethan settlement. He was seen as a coming man. He was a teacher at Oxford, and under Edward he was one of the chief disciples of Peter Martyr. He became public orator of the university in 1554. That's under Mary, just at the beginning of her reign. He was the notary to Cranmer and Ridley at their disputation when they were on trial or being disputed before their trial. And, of course, they were put to death. He fled to Frankfurt in 1555. There we see him siding against John Knox, Jewell in favour of the prayer book being used. But he soon joined Peter Martyr at Strasbourg. He accompanied him to Zurich. And upon Elizabeth's accession, he returned to England, and he was one of the disputants selected to confute the Romanists in conference. He was selected as preacher at St. Paul's Cross in London, very influential position. He challenged all comers to prove the Roman Catholic case out of the scriptures, all the councils, all the fathers of the first 600 years after Christ. He was clearly on a fast track to become Archbishop of Canterbury. He was early, sort of middle-aged by now, but he's now on a fast track. In 1560, he became Bishop of Salisbury, so that's only 2 years after he's come back, and constituted himself the literary defender of the Elizabethan settlement, producing in 1562 in Latin the Apologia Ecclesiae Anglicanae, the defence of the Anglican Church, the first methodical statement of the position of the Church of England against the Roman Catholic Church. In doctrine and practice, it forms the groundwork of all subsequent controversy for several centuries. Indeed, it was so influential, and Elizabeth liked it, and James liked it even more, and it was ordered to be placed in all churches in 1609, the only book alongside the Bible that was supposed to be in all churches. And yet, and this little example, I think, shows so much up of what we've been saying. He had a man in his diocese of Salisbury who was his friend, called Lawrence Humphrey. Lawrence Humphrey was a Puritan, and he wouldn't wear a surplice in the pulpit while he read the prayer book, and John Jewell imprisoned him. You see, it's come down to what clothes you wear. It seems so utterly trivial. And yet the whole issue is not trivial, is it? It's the issue between, do I, as a Christian, just obey the scriptures, or does the Queen have the right to come down into the minutiae of my life and my worship in my church and tell me that I've got to do certain things on pain of imprisonment? Who is really in charge of the church, Jesus Christ or Elizabeth I? Jewell attacked Cartwright's views in 1571 as he began to put forward Presbyterianism. And then in the providence of God, this rising star died. God took him away. I'm sure took him away so that he wouldn't attack his brothers anymore. Because surely this is a godly man, but just so mistaken. And starting from the wrong principle, the Queen is in charge of the church, and you end up imprisoning people for not wearing a particular garment. You see, it's a great lesson, isn't it, not to get small things too big, but also just if you start in the wrong place, you finish in the wrong place. You've got to start and you've got to finish in the scriptures. You've got to start and finish in the church is the church of those who are in Christ and gathered and separate from the state and running its own affairs under the lordship of Christ, appointing its own leaders, running its own worship according to the scriptures. And this was what many were now trying to get to. Now, Elizabeth died in 1602, and the struggle went on for over a century, and the next century certainly gets very busy, doesn't it, with James I, Charles I, Civil War, Second Charles, James II. But this is where we're at this point. This is where we need to stop to see this struggle has begun, and God willing, in future lectures, we'll see it developing.